legislation is compounded by the years of imprisonment and torture that Julian Assange has already suffered. The targets of the indictment, however, reach far beyond their immediate victim. They reach, in fact, to all of us who hope to understand what is happening in the world, and to the journalism profession, whose task it is to perform this essential service in a democratic order. Those who seek to perform this honorable task are under harsh attack in these troubled days. That's more reason to assure the attack on journalism will not be joined by the most powerful state in human history. In short, free Julian Assange without further unconscionable delay.
Noam Chomsky, speaking before the Belmarsh Tribunal on the case of Julian Assange, which took place Friday at the National Press Club. To watch the full 2.5-hour tribunal, go to democracynow.org. Special thanks to Charina Nadura, Dennis Moynihan, Ishmael Darrow, Mike Burke, Robbie Karen, Dina Guzder, and Julie Crosby. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
Did you know that KBOO podcasts all our news and talk shows?
You can find the podcast on KBOO's website, kboo.fm, on Google Play, iTunes, and Stitcher.
Just search for your favorite show and hit subscribe to get all the latest episodes downloaded to your favorite device.
Or search for KBOO on iTunes, Google Play to get all the KBOO podcasts.
Prison Pipeline is a radio program dedicated to educating the public about the Oregon criminal justice system. Topics include incarceration and reentry, addictions and mental health, elections and laws, victims' rights, and criminal justice reform. The program presents a unique understanding of the criminal justice system, addresses the root causes of crime, and challenges the status quo. It seeks to promote awareness and activism in order to foster a safer, healthier, and more just society.
Prison Pipeline airs on Monday evenings from 6:30 to 7 p.m. on KBOO Portland. Check us out every week. If you miss an episode, you can stream it later. Just go to kboo.fm/prisonpipeline. More info about upcoming shows and events related to the prison community can be found on our Facebook page, Prison Pipeline. Be sure to like us.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, 11 are dead after a mass shooting at a Lunar New Year event in California. Pacific Northwest lawmakers tackle food aid for immigrants and affordable housing, and experts weigh in on mitigating emissions from gas stoves. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, January 23rd, 2023. I'm Althea Billings. The death toll in a mass shooting in Monterey Park, California on Saturday has risen to 11. A gunman targeted a Lunar New Year celebration. KBOO's Josh Salem has more.
10 people were killed on Saturday in Monterey Park, California after a Lunar New Year celebration. This was the fifth mass killing this month. The alleged gunman was found dead in a van he used to flee the scene. Authorities believe he died of a self-inflicted gunshot. This was the deadliest attack since May 4, 2022, when 21 people were killed in an elementary school shooting in Uvalde, Texas. The assault could have been even more deadly. A 26-year-old man confronted the gunman and wrestled his weapon away from him. Officials have shared very little information concerning the suspected gunman, 72-year-old Hu Kin Tran. Monterey Park Mayor Henry Lowe said, quote, "We do understand that he may have had a history of visiting this dance hall, and perhaps the motivation has to do with some personal relationships. But that's something that I think investigators are still uncovering and investigating, and we'll probably find out more in the hours ahead or even days ahead," end quote. All of the people killed are believed to have been over 50, and no other suspects are at large. Tran was carrying a semi-automatic pistol with an extended magazine, and a second handgun was discovered in the van where he died. About 20 minutes after the first attack, Tran entered the Lai Lai Ballroom in the nearby city of Alhambra. Brandon Say was the man who seized the gun from Tran. He pointed it at the alleged shooter, telling him to leave the ballroom. He then called the police. Monterey Park is a city of about 60,000 people on the eastern edge of Los Angeles. It is a predominantly Asian-American community. The shootings happened in the heart of its downtown, where red lanterns decorated the streets for the Lunar New Year festivities. The Lunar New Year celebration in Monterey Park is one of California's largest. 2 days of festivities were planned. In the years past, they've been attended by as many as 100,000 people. But officials canceled events following the shooting. For KBOO News, I'm Josh Salem.
A bill in the Oregon legislature would extend food aid to over 60,000 more Oregonians who are currently excluded because of their immigration status. Eric Tegedoff reports.
A big gap exists in who can receive food assistance in Oregon. Lawmakers want to bridge that divide this session. Federal law excludes people who are undocumented from programs like the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, the country's largest food assistance program. The Food for All Oregonians bill would extend food aid to lawful permanent residents, U.S. Compacts of Free Association or COFA citizens, and other Oregonians who arrive as immigrants or refugees. Aldo Solano Mendez is with Oregon Food Bank and co-manager of the Food for All Oregonians campaign.
Oregon should be able to offer food assistance to all Oregonians, regardless of where they were born. Currently, about 62,000 Oregonians are excluded from vital food assistance programs like SNAP simply because of immigration status or where they were born.
More than 75 organizations across Oregon have endorsed the legislation. Mendez says immigrant community members and Oregonians of color are more likely to experience food insecurity. According to data from 2020, they were 2 to 3 times more likely to be food insecure than white Oregonians. Patrona Dominguez is with Adelante Mujeres, an organization that works with Latinas. She says the group hosted listening sessions with community members affected by food insecurity, which resulted in the bill.
We asked a selection of questions, and people told us their experiences and what it meant to be accessing food, what their experiences have been, and also how they might envision something that's pertainable to them.
Food for All Oregonians' other campaign manager, Fatima Jawad Mardi, says ensuring people can access food assistance is also an essential part of the legislation.
How are we making sure that our immigrant, refugee, and COFA community members are outreached to, that are able to get information in the languages that they need? And a huge part of this is having a community navigation program.
The bill has 17 co-sponsors in the House and Senate. Lawmakers will hold a public hearing for the legislation, but it's not scheduled yet. For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
When undocumented workers in Washington get laid off, they don't get unemployment benefits. Lawmakers in Olympia have plans to change that. KBOO's Eric Leuschner has the details.
Undocumented workers in Washington state don't have access to unemployment insurance. But some state lawmakers aim to fix that this session. The bill proposed in the House and Senate would create a wage replacement program for undocumented Washingtonians who lose their jobs. The Washington Immigrant Solidarity Network's Sasha Wasserstrom says immigrants are a vital part of the state's economy and calls this measure long overdue.
We are hoping for this legislation to pass in order for undocumented workers to finally get what is due to them, which is having that security that if they lose their jobs to no fault of their own, that they can have the same security that any other resident has of Washington state.
Wasserstrom says undocumented workers pay the taxes that support unemployment benefits but aren't eligible for them. Data from 2019 found households headed by undocumented immigrants paid $371 million in state and local taxes. But businesses are pushing back on this legislation, saying employers who knowingly hire ineligible workers face penalties under federal laws. Wasserstrom says workers who have no safety net when they're laid off put not only themselves in difficult situations, but their families as well.
We've heard so many stories of how not having that security has put folks in dangerous or violent situations, has created food insecurity issues for families, made it more dangerous for parents and children in the home without having the possibility of income replacement.
Other states have established programs to provide benefits for undocumented workers, including Colorado. The Senate version of the Washington state measure is scheduled for public hearing on Thursday. For KBOO News and the Public News Service, I'm Eric Leuschner.
Washington lawmakers are also considering new legislation to build more housing for low and middle income people. People at those income levels are at risk of being displaced since prices have skyrocketed in recent years. Eric Tegedoff has the story.
Washingtonians are being squeezed out of the housing market, and some state lawmakers want to see significant changes to city zoning laws to ensure that more people with low and middle incomes can afford a place to live. Alex Freeman-Smith is a phlebotomist at the University of Washington Medical Center Northwest and union delegate for SEIU 1199 NW. He says many people struggle to live in the community they serve because the hospital is located in an area surrounded by single-family homes where prices have skyrocketed.
Some of my coworkers even have to drive as far as from 2 hours away just to make it to work. And of course, in the event of an emergency, having your emergency staff 2 hours away isn't really effective for healthcare.
A measure in the Washington legislature would lift restrictions on building houses for more than one family, such as duplexes and triplexes. It has bipartisan sponsors. However, at a public hearing on the bill, a spokesman for the Association of Washington Cities expressed concerns that infrastructure costs could be passed down to cities. Anna Fahey with the Northwest-based think tank Sightline Institute says zoning restrictions drive urban sprawl, which ultimately hurts the environment.
Most of our cities are zoned primarily or almost exclusively for only one kind of housing, the biggest, most expensive kind. It's the kind that fits a single detached house that sits on a big lot.
The bill proposes that up to four homes on a single residential lot would be allowed in cities with populations of 6,000 or greater, or if they're located within the urban growth areas of major cities like Seattle. It would also allow up to six homes on lots within a half mile of frequent public transit stops. Fahey says this would be a major win, for workers especially.
They're modest in size and shape and are going to be available for people near jobs and available at prices that are more affordable to more people.
The Senate version of the bill is scheduled for a public hearing on Wednesday. For Washington News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Over the weekend, four dogs on their way to the Rose City Dog Show were stolen in a van on Hayden Island. The dogs have since been found and reunited with their owner. They belong to a Vancouver man, three Scottish Terriers and a Karen Terrier. The dogs were named Archie McPhee, Mustang Sally, Boo, and Mason. Their owner, Ed Cook, had stopped in Hayden Island at a friend's house to tell them it was time to go to the dog show when his van was stolen with the dogs inside. A Good Samaritan found the van later and refused the $10,000 reward. Vice President Kamala Harris promises to protect abortion on the 50th anniversary of Roe v. Wade, and Biden will hold talks with House Republicans on the debt limit. With more on these stories, it's Alex Gonzalez with 2022 Talks.
Welcome to 2023 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
The right of every woman in every state in this country to make decisions about her own body is on the line. And I've said it before, and I will say it again, how dare they?
In Tallahassee, Florida, Vice President Kamala Harris marked the 50th anniversary of Roe v. Wade yesterday by announcing an administration move to ensure access to abortion pills. The bills have been under a legal cloud in some states. And Harris says now that the Supreme Court has overturned Roe, the right is not a sure thing in any part of the country. Anti-abortion activists gathered on Friday in D.C. for the annual March for Life, the first since the court overturned federal abortion access protections. Organization President Gianna Mancini said their work isn't over. And now that the question has moved to the states, they'll push for more restrictions at every level.
While this year marks our most significant victory, the human rights abuse of abortion is far from over.
California Representative Judy Chu is calling on investigators to determine if the Monterey Park shooting that left 10 dead was a hate crime.
It is horrible that such a thing could occur at a time of celebration
for so many in the AAPI community and in the Asian community worldwide. This tore a hole through all of our hearts.
The shooting followed a day full of Lunar New Year celebrations. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis is pushing to ban COVID health measures, vaccine mandates, and mask requirements at schools and businesses, including rules for employees. DeSantis has also moved to block the teaching of AP African American Studies. That drew fire from White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre, who cited the state's so-called Don't Say Gay law.
These types of actions aren't new. They are not new from what we're seeing, especially from Florida, sadly. Florida currently bans teachers from talking about who they are and who they love.
The House of Representatives has reached agreement on the typically state issue of committee ratios and assignments. The new speaker did announce last week that controversial Representatives Marjorie Taylor Greene of Georgia and Paul Gosar of Arizona would regain the assignments they lost for backing the January 6th rioters. While addressing a bipartisan group of mayors at the White House, President Joe Biden said he will hold talks with Republican leaders on the national debt standoff.
The debt we're paying on, and we're going to have a little discussion about that with the new majority leader of the House, has accumulated over 200 years.
More classified documents have been found at President Biden's Delaware home. The classified documents range from his time in the Senate to his time as vice president. Finally, the federal government has seized close to $700 million in assets from FTX founder Sam Bankman-Fried. He has been accused of stealing billions from customers of the now bankrupt cryptocurrency giant. I'm Alex Gonzalez, her Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report on the Portland Public Schools students involved with decision-making in the district. At 6, it's Labor Radio. Then at 6:30, Prison Pipeline. Stick around at 7 for Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather is mostly cloudy with a low of 36. Tomorrow's weather will be cloudy as well with a daytime high of 47. Today in history, in 1964, the 24th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution is ratified, abolishing poll taxes in national elections. The quote of the day is from legendary American musician Chuck Berry, who said, quote, "It's amazing how much you can learn if your intentions are truly earnest." A recent report on emissions from gas stoves has many people reassessing their home appliances. Experts say that ventilation is key to mitigating the potentially dangerous effects of gas stove emissions. Catherine Carley has more on the story.
The health risks associated with gas-burning stoves have caused a recent stir and fears of a government ban on the appliances, but researchers say those risks have been well documented for decades. Gas stoves are known to emit nitrogen dioxide, and without proper ventilation, studies have shown indoor air pollution can worsen, causing respiratory illnesses like asthma. A recent study found 13% of childhood asthma cases are attributable to gas stove exposure. Dr. John Levy with Boston University's School of Public Health says the structure of a home will determine the risks.
For many people, things like gas stoves could actually be their highest source of air pollution exposure. That itself is important.
Levy says operating a range hood that vents outside or even opening windows makes a big difference. Without proper ventilation, standards of exposure to nitrogen oxides from gas-burning stoves can be exceeded within just a few minutes. Gas stoves are used in more than one-third of homes nationwide, but not every household can easily swap out their appliances, especially renters and low-income households, where the majority of asthmatic children live. Levy says studies have shown that improved ventilation in these homes pays for itself when it comes to asthma-related health care costs.
And so if we're thinking about folks who maybe are on MassHealth or on Medicaid, you know, this actually could be a wise government investment to try to reduce healthcare costs and health burden.
The Inflation Reduction Act, passed in 2021, offers homeowners tax incentives for swapping out gas stoves for electric induction versions, as well as other less energy efficient appliances. Levy says he would like to see the renewed focus on gas stoves help improve building codes, especially in low income housing developments. For Commonwealth News Service, I'm Catherine Carley.
Native farmers in northeast Nebraska are investing in more conservation practices on their farms. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A northeast Nebraska farming operation is starting the new year with an even bigger commitment to conservation, and they're hoping other farms take note. Deborah Van Fleet reports.
Cover cropping and organic farming are already practiced by the Winnebago Tribe's Ho-Chunk Farms. And through the USDA's Natural Resources Conservation Service EQIP program, they'll be adding more conservation practices this year. Farm Senior Manager Aaron LaPointe says they've enrolled all 3,500 of their irrigated acres into a technology-driven water conservation program known as the Water Smart Initiative.
There's lots of equipment that will inform you on your groundwater levels, which alerts you when to irrigate at the optimal time using the least amount of water. And also, if you're overwatering, that brings more of an issue when you start talking about leaching of different pesticides and herbicides and getting things into our groundwater.
The NRCS shares the upfront costs of water meters, soil moisture probes, weather stations, and inspecting irrigation pumps to be sure they're functioning properly. LaPointe says they're confident this will be a good long-term investment, both for water and soil health. LaPointe explains they've also enrolled all their irrigated acres into another NRCS program to monitor their herbicide and pesticide use.
It allows you to efficiently use a certain amount of chemical that you need to kill weeds without overdoing it, because any excess that you spray could eventually end up in groundwater or causing other issues and other things.
Ho-Chunk Farms is part of the Winnebago Tribe's Economic Development Corporation. It will plant nearly 7,000 acres this year. 1,000 will be cover crops, and another 1,000 will have organically certified crops. LaPointe says they hope their successes will encourage other farmers to take a look at what the NRCS offers.
We personally might sit here and say, well, is our 3,500 acres really making a difference? But if you start inspiring more people to do it, now you're starting to make some real change. And if there's somebody that's going to kind of set the trend and inspire people to maybe move in that direction, I think it should be us.
I'm Deborah Van Fleet.
Filmmakers of Imagining the Indian, the fight against Native American mascotting, joined demonstrators Saturday at the Kansas City football team's playoff game to advocate for the team to change its name and end the appropriation of Native culture. Producer Yancey Byrne says the experience showed him the importance of educating the public about the fight against Native American mascots. He says he witnessed people who came by the protest who may be open to dialogue, but says there was also a different side.
There's folks who maybe don't understand the issue, but are just not happy and are just willing to be awful. And then farther along on that spectrum are folks who just really have malice in their heart. And it's incredible that so many folks who, I think the ones who have malice in their heart probably understand less than the ones who are just on the other side of the spectrum who just don't understand anything, because there's no reason to have malice, especially towards the folks who are protesting. It was a peaceful, nonviolent protest. All the protesters for Not in Our Honor are asking for is to think about the issue, to change the name, to stop the chop. And there's no reason that the folks they're encountering should bring, you know, violence towards them, and that's what they're doing. And it was incredible to see.
The documentary examines the movement to end the use of Native American names, logos, and mascots in the world of sports and beyond. It was screened in Kansas City last week. The group Not in Our Honor hosts demonstrations during the NFL season outside the Kansas City football team's home games. The Kansas City football team has stated the team is continuing dialogue with the Native community to identify ways to educate and raise awareness of Native Americans. Native American NASA astronaut Nicole Mann took part in the first spacewalk of 2023 on Friday alongside a Japanese astronaut. They spent more than 7 hours working outside the International Space Station. Mann is the first Native American woman to go to space. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
In Montana, people are building fake beaver dams in drought-stricken areas. They're hoping the artificial dams will attract real beavers back to the area. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. In southwest Montana, landowners, volunteers, and others are wading into streams and piling up sticks, branches, and sod to create artificial beaver dams.
And it's immensely satisfying because if you're working in the spring, you build these structures and you just see the water back up right away.
That's Pedro Marquez with the Big Hole Watershed Committee. He says beaver were once common in the region, and the dams they built slowed water and allowed it to soak into the soil, so the area was marshier. But fur trappers decimated the beaver population. And with fewer beaver dams, snowmelt that trickled slowly into rivers and streams started flowing more quickly downstream. And climate change is making the problem worse. As temperatures rise, more precipitation is falling as rain instead of snow. So instead of melting slowly throughout the spring and summer, the water now rushes into streams, draining out of the area quickly. The structures Marquez's team is building mimic beaver dams. They slow the water down so it seeps into the soil and helps provide moisture over time. Marquez hopes the new dams will attract real beavers.
Eventually, the beaver will find that place and take over what we've started. That's really the end goal.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
It can be difficult to know how to help children deal with grief. Brett Pivoteau talks with a bereavement expert to learn more about how to best approach kids in their time of need.
Knowing how to approach the grief of others can be difficult, although things can get more complicated when addressing the grief of students in school settings. Estimates indicate that nearly 7% of children in the U.S. will experience the death of a sibling or parent by the age of 18. Overcoming the cultural taboo around dealing with grief is especially important for teachers and other education personnel. Jilly Cannon, director of Children's Bereavement Services at Caring Matters in Gaithersburg, says it's important for educators and families to work together to support a grieving child at school.
Schools are going to do three things. I need to show that they care about the student. I want them to show that they can listen deeply without judging. And I want them to let the student know that school is a safe place for them to be present in with their grief.
She says listening without judging involves being able to really hear the other person without needing to share your own experience or making a judgment about the validity of the other person's feelings. During these conversations, people have to deal with their own impulse to want to fix things for the other person or put a positive spin on the situation. Cannon recommends against both and says people should begin by acknowledging what's happened.
Let them know that you've heard that their person has died and that you are very sad about that news. So you're showing them that you are acknowledging it, you're aware of it. What you don't want to then do is to try and make them feel better.
Cannon believes that educators need to maintain the institutional awareness of the child's experience of loss and ensure it travels with them during their school years.
When a child is grieving, you need to ensure that as they move from class to class and grade to grade and school to school, that you're passing on that information that this child has had a significant loss. Because children revisit their grief as they grow. Their grief morphs and changes as they get older and they have milestones without that person.
Cannon also recommends people avoid well-intentioned cliches, such as the idea of the deceased person being in a better place or that they wouldn't want to see them cry. She says these kinds of cliches imply that a grieving person should feel better and hold back their tears, but the message communicated to the grieving person is that their feelings are not valid.
You don't want to diminish any of their feelings. You want them to be able to say how they're feeling and also to know that there's no good or bad feelings. There's feelings. There's no judgment on how they're feeling.
For Maryland News Connection, I'm Brett Pivoteau.
Dental hygienists are calling attention to the importance of oral health for children. It's tied to missing school and more severe health issues.
Dental hygienists are trying to raise awareness about the importance of oral hygiene, noting that dental pain is one of the most common reasons for school absenteeism among children. Studies show children with dental pain are three times more likely to miss school. In addition, a child or teenager with noticeable dental disorders, such as blackened teeth or tooth loss, can take a negative toll on their self-esteem. Betty Cable sees this all too often as a dental hygienist and director of dental outreach at North Florida Medical. She says for too long, people have treated oral hygiene as a secondary issue instead of a primary concern.
If a child has a broken arm, they would not be walking around with a broken arm. And your tooth, if it's an infection or it's abscess, it's broken and there's a problem. So it's not okay for a kid to be in tooth pain.
Student health is among the top causes for chronic absenteeism, which includes dental pain, vision problems, or mental health, according to the Healthy Schools campaign. Cable says there needs to be more awareness and expanded access for dental care, especially in rural areas. Cable says she hears firsthand from the children she treats who feel embarrassed and find it difficult to concentrate due to severe pain. She warns there are worse outcomes for untreated dental problems.
Children die from tooth infections. I mean, the infection is right there next to their brain. It's in their bloodstream. So it's a matter of life and death when you're walking around with an infection in your mouth.
Florida is among the top states in the nation with individuals living in dental health professional shortage areas. And Cable says her organization tries to fill the gaps by working with parents and caregivers to try to treat kids who end up in their school nurses' offices with severe pain. She says there are just not a lot of providers that see children, so they do their best to get kids into the ones that do provide care to kids. This is Tramel Gomes for Florida News Connection.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Monday, January 23rd, 2023. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem, Eric Leuschner, and Owen Bastable. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Antonia Gonzalez, Eric Tegedoff, Catherine Carley, Brett Pivoteau, Alex Gonzalez, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. Thank you. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in depth.